The talk I'm going to give today is taken actually from a longer paper. I've never given any of this other talk before. I always distribute the paper as a workshop, so we'll see how this works. The longer paper it's excerpted from is called The Dialectic Between Nature and Culture in Later Nietzsche. And that paper has two halves. The first half of the paper tries to identify a crucial metaphysical assumption, which I'm going to suggest Nietzsche is trying to reject in his later work, especially the genealogy of morals. And the second half of that paper, I try to show, once we understand that part of Nietzsche's aim is to reject that assumption, that it enables us to understand what Nietzsche's actually doing in the final third, book three of the genealogy of morals. That's the part which is concerned with answering the question with which he starts book three. The question is, what is the meaning of ascetic ideals? In book three, he gives a certain answer to that question. Now, today, the talk is just going to be the first half of that paper, because there's just no way to get it all on a talk. I tried. It just got too crowded. So the first half of that paper is called, as it says on your handout, Nietzsche's Critique of the Layer Cake Conception of Human-Mindedness. So the talk is concerned with this first half of the paper, the crucial assumption Nietzsche's trying to reject. And then in the discussion, if you'd like, we could go into the implications of this for reading the genealogy. I have some things about that in the handout, but I won't try to do that in the talk. So the talk is, if you will, the prolegomena to the reading of Nietzsche. But before I jump into the details of that talk, I thought I'd say something about how the topic of the talk, and indeed the longer paper from which it's drawn, is connected to two papers which I published over Nietzsche, about Nietzsche, which I've given both as talks here in Bergen over the years. Indeed, one of them formed the framework for a seminar I taught here in Bergen, and which some of you are familiar with. I thought I might as well connect what you have heard before from me, for those of you who have heard something, from what I'm doing now. So there's two papers. One's about Nietzsche's perfectionism, as I call it, and the other is about Nietzsche's perspectivism, as it is called, I too call it. The first of those papers is just called Nietzsche's Perfectionism. And in that paper, I argue that Nietzsche's concerned to elaborate and defend a radical form of what I'm there calling moral perfectionism. And the end of that paper has some suggestions about how later Nietzsche's later philosophy emerges from his early perfectionism. And part of what I'm doing is now fleshing out those suggestions in this longer paper. The second of those two papers of mine is called The Dialectic of Perspectivism. That's the one I actually taught a seminar on, which I think Alois recorded, if you want to hear it. And it argues that Nietzsche's conception of perspectivism undergoes considerable evolution over his lifetime. If you think there's one thing which is Nietzsche's perspectivism, and all his remarks and all of his different writings are expressions of it, you'll get into a lot of trouble. Indeed, his later perspectivism, I argue, was a critique of his earlier perspectivism. And then, of course, in that paper at the end, what I'm really concerned with is his own mature view, what I will call his mature perspectivism. Now, what I'll do now is just say a little bit more about each of the central ideas in those two earlier papers in order to be able to say something about how my talk today tries to connect the two papers. And then I'll move on to the main topic of the talk, what I'm calling Nietzsche's Critique of the Layer Cake Conception. I'll explain what that is. And then at the very end, I'll just gesture at book three of the Genealogy of Morals, and then we can go into that in more detail in the discussion if you want to. But maybe a word about the handout. You have this mama long handout here, so let me just reassure you about it. It contains two things. It contains quotations, which I mostly won't read. They're there, so if you want to go see whether what I say is true, or what I'm pointing to, you have the basis for a discussion with me. Or it contains things that summarize in a helpful way what I will be saying. If you want to go back and say, what was the first reading? What was the second reading? What is the layer cake conception? You just want a quick, brief statement, and they're on the handout. So the talk's going to go a bit quickly, so the handout is sort of there to basically provide you with things you can look back on that might help us in the discussion, so that you don't need to have perfect knowledge and recall of everything in order to join battle with me about these matters. So now, in that first of those two papers of mine I mentioned, the one about Nietzsche's perfectionism, it starts off as a reading of a very early work of Nietzsche's from 1874, one of his Unzeitgemäße Betrachtungen, untimely meditations, observations, essay called Schopenhauer as Educator. And there's a certain passage from that essay that gets quoted over and over again by American moral philosophers. It's the first item on your handout. And in that essay, I talk about how this is standardly read, and then I criticize that reading, and I try to give a better reading of that passage. That passage involves the idea that the way to go about conferring what Nietzsche calls the greatest possible value upon your life, this passage is an answer to the question, how can you go about giving your life the greatest value? He says, is to relate yourself to something or someone that Nietzsche calls a higher self. And in the standard, what I call elitist reading of Nietzsche, is the higher self is some great man, has nothing to do with you, and Nietzsche becomes what we might call an excellence consequentialist. You know, his view is to sort of maximize what I guess the Germans now call Exzellenzklüster. And Nietzsche's goal is to just kind of create one of those out of great men, and the rest of us should help make that happen. In the paper, I argue that you have to read Nietzsche pretty badly to come out with that reading, that our higher self, as I think even this passage makes clear if one reads it carefully, is a state of our future self. He does think such higher selves are disclosed to us, first, by focusing on people who are not us, whom we admire. But ultimately, part of their goal is to initiate a process in which we take conscious possession of ourselves in such a way that we start to undo all kinds of layers of socialization and habituation, which then allow us to go about transforming ourselves in some way. So that when Nietzsche is concerned with the process of self-transformation, will most of us do it? He thinks no. But in principle, he thinks anybody could. Very important that we are excluded from this process. It's because, as he says, we exclude ourselves. And indeed, he sees our usual way of thinking about great men, thinking of them, as it were, as the Michael Jordans of philosophy or literature or poetry or ethics, as a way of insulating ourselves from the admonition that, well, he can do that, he's a great man. And even our festivals, our statues, the way we discuss the great philosophers, we name streets and he sees as one huge process of trying to protect ourselves from the claim he thinks they make of us. So he's an enormous critic of what he calls cultural philistinism. But not because he thinks they're great and we're not, and that's the point. That's the fall into the very trap he's criticizing. Now, two further claims about this perfectionist process that he's thematizing there as it pertains to the individual. First, Nietzsche thinks that's not something you do only once, and once you've done it, you're done. You've, as it were, perfected yourselves, and now you have achieved your higher self. So the task of self-perfection at issue here, secondly, is not something that Nietzsche thinks you're thinking about in the right way, if you think it has a fixed telos, if it should or could culminate in something you can think of as your perfected self. The task is, as he puts it, an endless one of leaning your presently attained self always on a further unattained but attainable self. I've given you a long quotation from that paper, my quotation too, if you want to sort of see what this sounds like. I won't read it out. But I dare say a bit about how Nietzsche pictures the flourishing human being, namely as a series of such successively attainable selves, each once attained leaning towards a further unattained yet attainable successor. And I argue there that means his essay is structured by two gazes. So his essay itself is trying to do something that it also talks about. Give us an example of such a process of self-transformation. These two gazes look backwards on something that Nietzsche thinks he's done, and forward towards something he has not yet done in 1874. The gaze that looks backwards has to do with how the author of the third untimely meditation became who he presently is at the time of writing, And the second gaze looks forward to who he's struggling to become, someone he knows he's not. And that's accomplished by his depicting his relation to two different, as he calls them, exemplars. The one is Schopenhauer, someone he says he can boast of as previously been his teacher, but who he can now criticize in this essay. And the other is Emerson, someone from whom he is trying to learn at this point, and therefore does not quite know how to engage with. And part of what I show in the essay is how he does that. What's important for my topic today is that this process he describes there, and which is a topic of Nietzsche, especially early in Nietzsche, a topic of what's involved in individual creative self-transformation, also has a counterpart in another topic, a topic of what we might call cultural or social transformation of individuals, and the way in which the one process can serve to open channels through which the other flows, so that certain things that certain individuals do eventually lead to seismic shifts in entire forms of life. Topic that interests Nietzsche. How something that quietly is happening and somebody writing something can ultimately lead to something that's appropriate in a certain way, so that what human beings are changed down the line. His favorite examples of these processes are Socrates and Jesus, but not his only ones. Observations tied to two further things that are important to Nietzsche, two further claims, and these are now at no longer concerned at all with just the transformation at the level of the individual, but at the level of culture. The first of these two claims is that these sorts of changes that are first very difficult for an individual, it requires an enormous self-conscious effort on the part of someone to hold a certain ideal up before himself and then try to transform who he is in the light of that ideal. Over time, can then, at a later point in human history, be a kind of change that's affected in later people simply through a process of somebody growing up in a certain culture, more or less effortlessly. A kind of way of relating to one's instincts, or a kind of way of behaving, or a kind of way of thinking that's almost impossible for somebody at one stage is almost impossibly avoidable for a human being at a later stage because of what a process of cultural initiation has been. And secondly, these acquired forms of selfhood that come through a process of social initiation, once they're attained and fully incorporated into the shared structure of selves in a particular form of life, can become embodied at such a deep layer of the selves involved, that Nietzsche thinks it becomes appropriate to speak of them as having acquired the aspect of instincts. We have a new kind of instinct. What attracts us or recoils us, or what is, as it were, it seems like the expression of our deepest nature in this way, itself has been produced in this form. And part of the topic of this talk is really, what does he mean when he talks this way about these kinds of instincts? This is what I think has been misunderstood. These kinds of changes, these, if you will, culturally acquired instincts, if that sounds like a contradiction, that's okay with me. That's the difficulty of what that could mean is our topic. Where the degree of change here, where this kind of degree or depth of change is attained, for Nietzsche always marks a change in the kind of an animal that a human being now is. The human being is an animal who changes the very nature of the kind of animal he is. That serves, I think, is quite a good definition of what Nietzsche thinks, late Nietzsche thinks, is special about the human animal. And so what we want to do is try to make sense of that idea. And in order to do that, I think we have to pull out and really target the metaphysical assumption of the topic of the rest of this talk. That is, we have to learn how to make the right kind of sense of how the concepts animal and human are related to one, how they are to be thought together. That's all I'll say about perfectionism. Now a few words about perspectivism. That's our main topic. Perspectivism is the idea that human knowledge, or what passes for it, is in, now I'm going to put this really vaguely on purpose, in some way, somehow, a function of the cognitive perspective we bring to our encounter with the object that we're trying to know. And those weasel words, in some way, somehow, are crucial to the formulation, because how you spell out that variable in the formulation will determine how vicious or fruitful a doctrine of perspectivism turns out to be. And in the second paper I mentioned before, The Dialectic of Perspectivism, the one I taught a course about in Bergen, one of the things I try to show is that Nietzsche fills in that variable in very different ways, at different points over the course of his lifetime. Early on, he has a way of understanding how the perspective we bring to the object of knowledge colors or infects or structures the object of knowledge so that it looks like we can't ever really have knowledge. What we understand of things is just what we bring to it. And so the very idea of perspectivism, the very idea that perspectivism might be true, leads to a kind of skepticism, or what later Nietzsche calls nihilism, about knowledge. And then I'm interested in how Nietzsche, by the time of the genealogy of morals, also in the third essay, comes to criticize that view. So that paper takes what's quotation 3 on your handout, that's section 12 of part 3 of the genealogy, to be a definitive expression of Nietzsche's mature perspectivism. I show how it's a criticism of what you might call the nihilistic version of skepticism that he earlier held. In the text, and there, before your quotation begins on 3, in section 12, the beginning of section 12 of the genealogy, Nietzsche begins by announcing the need to, as he puts it, rethink the entire conceptual antithesis, subject and object. And we need to rethink in such a way as to avoid what he calls the aesthetic self-contempt and self-mockery of reason that declares there's a realm of truth in being, but reason is excluded from it. In criticizing that idea, he is criticizing his earlier self. Nietzsche now wants to see how the receptive capacities through which an object affects a subject, and how the intellectual capacities through which the subject then structures his experience of the object, can now be thought of, to put it very simply, as two sides of a single coin, rather than as two separate moments in a two-stage process in which the second defeat the first. So that second of my papers, The Dialectic of Perspectivism, is concerned to develop what we might call this two sides of one coin reading of Nietzsche's mature perspectivism. I provide a quotation 4 in your handout, which kind of summarizes my view of that in the paper, if you want to see that at more length. And I say there that Nietzsche's mature way of unpacking this relation between knower and object known, between our forms of cognition and the object of knowledge, which they can now allow to come into view rather than just screen from view, that view is one in which we have to rethink the terms subjective and objective so that they can both apply to the same cognitive process, rather than, as Nietzsche thinks is the tendency up to now in the history of philosophy, his earlier thought, to understand those terms so they crowd each other out. They're opposite. We have to see a way in which a feature of experience can be subjective in this sense, that what we know is constitutively dependent upon our perceptual or value perspective, while at the same time being objective, in the sense that the exercise of those capacities allow us to get views of the thing that we can see as more accurate, more reliable, as he puts in that quotation, more objective. But it's important here that objective is a matter of degree. It's not that you're ever done. This way of conceiving of the interrelationship between the subjective and subjective aspects of experience or knowledge entails, however, something very important, which he comes to see by the time he writes the genealogy. Namely, that the most primordial animal aspects of our subjectivity, the way in which we respond to things, perceptually, emotionally, affectively, orectically, and otherwise, can undergo alteration, indeed, must undergo alteration. An alteration in which they become responsive, even at the very deepest level, to culturally acquired forms of understanding, conception, and evaluation that only came later in the history of this animal that I am. A full appreciation of that point requires that Nietzsche's perspectivism be able to accommodate itself to a perfectionism sufficiently thoroughgoing that what we are perfecting and perfecting ourselves is able to reach all the way down into the deepest nature, aspects of our animal nature. And in particular, in order for the epistemology to make sense, our capacity for perception, what it is to be affected by something in a perceptual transaction. The crucial idea in epistemology, its epistemological aspect, might be summarized as follows. What perception itself is in the human animal is something that is perfectible in the sense that it too is able to undergo an infinite process of further transformation. It might be that some of the biological substrata of the machinery we have is inherited through our animal nature, but what it can do and the proper understanding of what it's doing itself is perfectible in this way. In order to accommodate that thought, Nietzsche has to rethink his whole understanding of what's involved in the very idea of the exercise of a perceptual capacity. That's what my second essay is about. What this talks about is how he came to see that this also affected the very idea of the exercise of a motivational capacity, what it is to act, and therefore his very idea of human desire or motivation, that is what it is to have a capacity to act in desire or an appetite or even an instinct. Okay, having said only this much, already quite a few questions might occur to you. I think quite a few questions arise about now how should we understand the relation between what I call Nietzsche's perfectionism and what I call his perspectivism. And in the rest of the talk today, I'll be concerned with just one of these questions. I think there are several interesting questions that come up here. But the one I'll be concerned with is this one. What's the underlying shape of the conception we need to have of what it is to be human, or what kind of animal the human animal is, so that it allows these two ideas, or these two strains in Nietzsche's thought, the perfectionist and the perspectivist, to come happily together in a single coherent conception? I think it's hard to do this. I think this was the tension, the heart of his philosophy he's trying to solve in the genome. For most of Nietzsche's philosophical careers, something like three quarters to four fifths of it. For most of his career, his thought is beset by basically a tension between these two aspects, between his perfectionist conception of what confers value on human life through self-transformation, and an interfering metaphysical premise that will be my topic. An interfering metaphysical premise about what sort of creature a human animal is that wrecks the possibility of pulling off the kind of view that he wanted. It's a premise that shaped his earlier attempts to articulate a perspectivist epistemology. It's also a premise, I think, which is still mainstream in contemporary analytic philosophy, which is the kind of philosophy I know best, actually. And so my topic is what it took for Nietzsche to free himself from that premise. And that's the premise I'm calling the layer cake conception. Now, although the crucial move of breaking with this conception is under preparation over much of his career, I don't think Nietzsche is really able definitively to part with the assumption until the genealogy of morals. And I don't think it's an accident that that's the same moment at which he achieves a formulation of what I call his mature perspective. Or to put this a little more sharply, Nietzsche's attaining his mature perspectivism is not accidentally connected with that moment in his development in which he finally succeeds in fashioning a conception of the nature of our cognitive capacities as human animals that's able to fully cohere with a radical perfectionism in which we are capable of changing the deepest aspects of ourselves. Now, what we want to do is pinpoint this underlying, as I called it, interfering metaphysical premise. The premise Nietzsche needs to take fully within his philosophical target range in order to reconcile his perspectivism and perfectionism. It's helpful to do this against the background, I think, of a certain kind of debate, which one can see in Nietzsche commentary. I think a lot of Nietzsche commentators are divided on the issue. This takes us to part two of the handout, which I'll call, no, it's now part three, isn't it? Which is called Nietzsche and the Relation Between Nature and Culture. Now, I think just about any commentator is paying attention will be happy to agree, and so you often find a remark, that Nietzsche is interested in parts of ourselves that go deeper, that reach farther into our being, as it sometimes says, than anything we can consciously control. And he's often, in this respect, contrasted with contemporary philosophers interested in things like thought and belief and other kinds of processes over which are fully within the scope of our will. And so it's remarked that Nietzsche's interest in how these aspects of ourselves came into being, how they relate to other aspects of ourselves, what kind of change they're susceptible of, what it would be to change them. And indeed, especially in the genealogy of morals, the text that I focus on the second part of my essay, he seems to especially set the person he calls the philosopher of the future the task of transforming what he at one point calls our pre-reflective attitudes. And this is a topic that much Nietzsche secondary literature discusses, often under something like the heading of Nietzsche's moral psychology. So one of the points in my essay is, if we see this only as a topic of moral psychology, and not as a fundamental question of the metaphysics, what kind of creature we are, we miss the depth at which Nietzsche's prosecutes his critique of both the tradition and his earlier self. I have a quotation from Robert Pippin on your handout. This is number 5. I think I might actually read this one, just to get you to play with your handout for a minute. The historical aspect of Nietzsche's primordial question needs to be stressed, because the main difference between Nietzschean psychology on the one hand, and both Greek and French moral psychology, he's taking these as two great moments in the history of moral psychology, on the other, stems from his insistence on the necessity of an historical dimension to any logos of any psyche. His assumption that psychic functioning is always a second nature, a kind of historical result, a product. I think I'm basically sympathetic to what Pippin's saying here, but I want to understand, what does it really mean? And what does Nietzsche have to criticize in the tradition of his earlier self to be entitled to hold such a view? So Pippin is here insisting that for Nietzsche, there's a necessary historical dimension to any logos, any account of psyche. And the question here is, how should we formulate the character of this historical dimension? Or to put it differently, what does it mean to speak here of what happens over time as a case of our acquiring a second nature? That can be a light metaphor or a heavy metaphor, the metaphor of a second nature. And I think within the commentary, commentators almost quoting the same passages from Nietzsche here in this area wind up making things of it that go off in very different directions. And I'd like to distinguish two broad directions here, and they figure as items 7 and 8 on your handout. I'll summarize them there briefly, and I'll do so on a little more length right now. So we have two readings of Nietzsche. Either one or the other of these readings tends to be attributed by a given commentator to Nietzsche's philosophy as a whole. The first thing I want to say is that I think actually Nietzsche's intellectual evolution is going from being a philosopher who's properly read as holding the first view to one who's properly read as holding the second view. So we don't want to just figure out what Nietzsche thinks about this issue. On the first reading, It's held that this pre-reflective moment that he emphasizes lies so deep in our nature that it seems to be, that it precedes anything that is properly thought to belong to what I will call our mindedness. That it's beyond the scope of our rational capacities, of our will, and so forth. Anything that belongs to our later human, culturally acquired nature. And that this deeper pre or sub or non-reflective half of our nature is something that persists unchanged as part of who we are, alongside the other half of our nature that's worked upon by culture, morality, traditional philosophy, your mother, your friends, your teachers, and so on. Hence I say a dualist conception, an unchangeable animal part, and then another layer that gets shaped and stands more or less stably on the first part. And then on this standard way of having a dualist reading, Nietzsche's point is that culture has shaped us into something that fits very badly with this other half of our nature. So we're now these sick creatures. And we need to be healed because we need to align this second acquired half of our nature with this deeper animal part of our nature with which we don't fit. Both these readings, I think any good reading of Nietzsche will see us as sick and we're needing a certain kind of cure. The question is, what's the diagnosis? The diagnosis here has a dualist structure. Two halves that don't fit together anymore. An extreme version of this thesis can be found in some recent writings of Rudiger Safransky, including his biography of Nietzsche, in which he attributes an enthusiasm on Nietzsche's part for what Safransky calls bicameral thinking. And there are passages in early and middle Nietzsche that I think do support such a reading. And just to be honest about this and not to hide it, I've given you quotation 6, which is a very good example of someone who does think about us in this way, but there are many others. That passage combines, if you will, a dualism of our primordial nature and our culturally acquired nature. And I think it helps lead to what I call the problematic epistemology of Nietzsche's immature perspectivism. So what I'm calling now on the handout, the first reading of Nietzsche and the relation between nature and culture, is well supported by many passages that we're only reading up to a certain point in Nietzsche's career. And the question I want to pose is whether such a reading provides the right interpretive lines for approaching the genealogy and some of Nietzsche's later writings. But first, let's understand this first reading better. On this first understanding of the matter, according to Nietzsche, on the dualist reading, what philosophy needs to do is to bypass, as it were, all the noise that's been created by the development of our Socratic capacities, and address us as effective instinctual beings. You'll recognize this as being, for instance, from the Birth of Tragedy. To address a part of our being that is conceived of as, in principle, not only presently in practice, beyond the reach of those reflective capacities, those self-critical capacities. That's the first reading, to which I want to contrast the second reading. The other way of understanding Nietzsche's emphasis on this, as it were, apparently instinctual aspect of our present nature is not to see it as constituting a part of our being that simply, in principle, lies outside the influence of our higher forms of mindedness, but rather one in which it's seen as lying within such a reach and susceptible to transformation by it, but nonetheless as having become sedimented in a particular historical moment in such a form that it presently strikes us, and indeed in a certain sense is, a kind of second nature that we have in our present form. But to say it's a second nature is to say that second nature too is capable, under different circumstances, of further alteration. And once such a transformation has been accomplished, then we'll presently be able to experience a newly acquired nature as a further, now intellectual feature of our merely natural capacities, and we'll look back on our previous second nature as something that we can no longer see, as we see our present second nature as a kind of first nature. So the mistake is to see our second nature as if it were necessarily a kind of second nature. I call these two ways of reading Nietzsche on the handout, where I distinguish them in 7 and 8, as the dualist reading and the dialectical reading. On the first reading, the dualist reading, what we need to do, if we're trying to follow Nietzsche, is to find a way to bypass the noise of our intellect and work directly on re-liberating our animal nature, trying to affirm aspects of our being that have been repressed or denied or shunted. On the second, when I'm calling dialectical reading, what philosophy needs to do is to help us to understand the ways in which, though we are animals, we are like no other mammal. Not only being able to make a question out of what sort of animal we are and we wish to be, and to make that question indeed our guiding question, but further, in our also then being able to realize our preferred answers to that guiding question. For we are animals that are themselves sensitive to what they value, and thus self-malleable by those forms of valuation. That's the topic of the genealogy, in striking the question of what he calls the value of value. Thus, philosophy must find a way to address us, so to make this part of our beings, which on the first reading just looks like it's part of our merely animal nature, first visible to us as something sensitive to, indeed in part produced by, our forms of valuation, but therefore also as mutable, and in principle a transformable feature of our overall nature. And this requires bringing those aspects of our second nature, which now appear to us as first nature, within the sphere of a certain kind of critical reflection, and the light of our critical assessment of the sorts of beings we want to become, targeting those aspects of our pre-reflective nature as aspects of ourselves that are to undergo further transformation. And that we must do this, Nietzsche thinks, if we are to reshape our own nature in ways that will allow us to become who we want to be. So, two ways of understanding Nietzsche. The first way understands him to be operating with a strong dualism between the nature of our pre-reflective selves and our reflective selves, between two aspects of our nature. Sometimes these are conceived of as the conscious and unconscious selves, instinctual or intellectual selves, erotic or spiritual selves. These are all variations on the same theme, as far as I'm concerned, as long as these are understood as antitheses to one another. There are many ways to parse the structure of that dualism. And one or another of these ways of reading each, I think, is the mainstream stuff in reading. But I think it precisely misses what later Nietzsche came to think was so interesting about the character of the advent, as he puts it, of the human animal. Namely, that our sensible nature has shown itself over history to be susceptible of extraordinary transformation. Transformation through and through. By means of a sort of reverse operation, exercise back upon itself through our evaluative capacities. And that the standing possibility of a further such exercise holds open the promise of an indefinitely extendable sequence of further ways in which we could transform ourselves. So for Nietzsche, this now becomes what he thinks of as the task of philosophy, properly practiced, to help us to begin to bring our possibilities for self-transformation in ways that have largely been the product of cultural forces within our individual control. Now, these two ways of reading Nietzsche, I've just sketched, the dualist and the dialectical, have profoundly different implications for how we understand what I call the dialectic of nature and culture in Nietzsche's mature thought. The first reading tends to see our animal nature as something that is corrupted by the advent of civilization, and in need of rescue and release and other forms of therapy and comfort. So we get, at the extreme, what we might call a primitivist reading, according to which Nietzsche is concerned to celebrate instinct at the expense of thought, to champion immediate reactions over conscious forms of will. The most influential such reading Nietzsche came with National Socialism, But strangely, though much of the National Socialist reading of Nietzsche has been repudiated in contemporary scholarship, I think this feature of it lives on. On the second reading, we'll not just be able to pit instinct against reason in this way, because the very idea that that's what's going on participates in an assumption that Nietzsche wants to target. One can't allow that Nietzsche's concern to emphasize how deeply rooted in us presently certain forms of thought and evaluation are, so that they have, in effect, become or appear to us as forms of instinct. But we will not see such a description of a given form of thought or evaluation as the last word, and therefore is itself counting for or against the form of instinct in question. What will settle that question is a much more complicated matter. Now, commentators will make broad sweeping claims about Nietzsche's thought, some of which fit the second way of reading Nietzsche better than the first, some of which fit the first way better than the second. But the tendency, I think, is actually to wind up noticing there's something right about both of these ways of Nietzsche, reading Nietzsche, and therefore to say some things that sound like the one and to say some things that sound like the other. And I want to bring out these two readings and hold them clearly before you, because I think they contradict each other. If Nietzsche has a coherent philosophy in his mature writings, he needs to decide whether he wants to turn right or not. But I think he does. So I think that we have to see how Nietzsche overcomes the tension that comes with these two readings if we want a single coherent reading of his mature thought. Okay, so now we come, I've left you in suspense quite a while, to the layer cake conception of human mindedness, which I'm suggesting is the crucial assumption here that underlies the first reading and must be rejected, root and branch, if we really want to be able to have a view of the second form. On item 9 on your handout, you have a quick gloss of it. I'm putting it very picturesquely first, so you have a little picture which you can accompany in your representation of this. And then I'll try to be a little more precise about what it is. Theories that partake of this conception presuppose a particular understanding of the relation between mind and nature in the human animal. Or, if you will, the relation between our natural capacities, things like sensing, desiring, and our culturally acquired capacities, things like promise-making and promise-keeping, to take a very important example for genealogy. The conception assumes that the relation in question is sort of like the relation between two layers of a layer cake. Say it's a cake that's made out of chocolate and vanilla, for simplicity's sake. So the two layers are visually clearly distinguishable. And you're looking at the cake before you. Just as the upper vanilla half of the cake just sits simply atop the lower chocolate layer, without in any way fundamentally affecting the shape, flavor, or texture of the chocolate half of the cake, I can take the vanilla layer back off and just eat the chocolate layer if I want. And putting the vanilla layer on it, the chocolate layer does not change its nature or color or chemical composition. They just sit one atop the other. So too, according to this conception, in the human animal, the intellectual capacities, the culturally acquired capacities, just sit atop the purely pre-reflective, pre-intellectual, lower level nature of the animal, the nature the animal had before culture started to, we can now say, add something to it. Because the fundamental conception here is an additive one, a culture supplementing the character of the animal. Thus formulated, the conception involves a claim about the synchronic structure of the sort of animal we presently are. But it also presupposes a certain diachronic conception of how we come to be such an animal. According to that conception, what attains over the course of historical and cultural development is best thought of on the model of accretion. We accrete new capacities, such as the capacity to make or keep promises, and these are super added to our originally existing repertoire of natural capacities, like to flee in fear, or to notice something moving at 50 feet. On this picture, there's a fundamental dualism of capacities. Those that belong to our pre-existing natural animal endowments, and they are fixed in place once and for all, and those that belong to a super-added set of capacities that are culturally acquired and taken individually, each further optimal and taken as a set, further expandable. But all of this, as it were, alteration to the vanilla layer has no effect on the chocolate. So the following evolutionary corollary is actually, I think, essential to what I'm calling here the layer cake conception. That the later culturally acquired sets of capacities are, as I put it, simply laid on top of the earlier fixed ones, without in any way fundamentally transforming the character of what's there in the lower layer upon which the upper layer sits. The point of this image of the layer cake is to mark a significant implication of the conception, namely that an account of what a human mind is on this view must begin with an account of what it is to perceive and desire in terms which do not presuppose the capacity to speak, deliberate, or critically reflect on or otherwise adjust one's values. And in this sense, the layer cake conception regarding our powers of language and reason is one in which those abilities are, and now I'll quote an American philosopher like Matthew Boyle, a conception in which those powers are just tacked on to a sort of like thumbtacks added something else, to a mind that already has sensibility and desire, where the latter comprise an itself standing system of capacities apart from that addition. So if we want to understand what human perceiving is, we have to understand the animal part of the system, and then the intellectual part where we form beliefs, and see how those two, as it were, as philosophers nowadays like to say, modules interact. But the two modules in themselves must have distinct functions that are self-standingly intelligible. The layer cake conception runs not only very deep in Nietzsche's earlier thought, it runs very deep throughout the history of philosophy. I think it actually becomes entrenched in the early modern period. And it's very much alive in contemporary philosophy. So I mean to be talking about something in Nietzsche which I think should interest the contemporary philosopher again. Indeed, I think it's equally tenacious in contemporary analytic theoretic and contemporary analytic practical philosophy. In the paper of Matthew Boyle's I quoted, he presents two quotations, one from Gareth Evans and one from David Velleman. And I use those same two quotations here because I notice they contrast beautifully with what Nietzsche's doing in the third essay of the genealogy. So I've given them to you as quotations 10 and 11. We might want to look at them in the discussion. I won't read them now because I'm going to try to conclude in a few minutes. I'll just say this much about Evans and Velleman. Evans is giving a story about the perceptual process and how the information processing module, which is a function of our animal endowments, is then combined with the belief-forming module. Velleman's talking about our capacity to act, and how the motivational module, which he again sees as part of our animal endowment, then interacts with something that formulates conceptions of means and end, which to have the one realize the other. But they both suggest, there are different topics in theoretical and practical philosophy notwithstanding, that a central aspect of our ability to engage as rational creatures, be it rational knowers or rational agents, a central aspect of our ability to engage as rational creatures with the world around us, for Evans, our power to learn about the world through perception, for development, our capacity to implement our aims and action, should be thought of as, in this sense, built up out of two intelligibly self-standing components. That's the point which I try to make clear on quotation 12. Let me head up. So this comes to what I call the boring statement, as opposed to the picturesque, as it were, patisserie version of the layer cake conception, when I'm actually trying to state it as a philosophical thesis. So there's two components. There's a more primordial system, which in each case we always share with what I'll just allow myself to call the non-rational animals. Certain kind of perceptual system for Velleman, certain kind of motivational system for Evans, certain kind of motivational system for Velleman. And there's a second component, which tends to get called as something like a reasoning system, which, and then I take words from our quotations, monitor the activities in the more primordial system, assess the warrant for those activities, regulate those activities in response to assessment. So the one acts on the structure the other willy-nilly already has independent of it, in a kind of feedback response loop. As both authors note, it's not enough for these two systems to merely coexist. They realize there's a danger of a Humpty Dumpty problem here. We need a transect across which they are responsive to each other. They must normally, as they say, exhibit a certain harmony. And this requirement of harmony implies that at least when the two systems are, and then you'll hear things like, functioning normally, we can think of them as constituting a single total system and a single total state, in a certain sense. A state for which we can reserve a term like the ones Evans does for his topic, conscious perceptual experience. So this single sort of state, we have a condition produced when sensory input is received in a way that then seems to seamlessly govern, because all goes well, both our behavioral dispositions and our reflective thought. And then once we've coined such a term for the total state, conscious perceptual experience or successful rational action, we can say that only rational creatures can be in such a state. So we can say, oh, in our view, humans are very different than animals because only they can be in that total state. But this should not mislead us about the crucial point. It should not mislead us into thinking that such views recognize what later Nietzsche thinks is the realm of sort of fundamental difference between, say, rational and merely animal perception, or human and merely animal desire. They recognize a difference of the sort I just described, but not what would count by Nietzsche's lights as a fundamental difference. For they hold that rational perception, in Evans's case, amounts to merely animal perception harmoniously integrated into the operations of, this is Evans, the thinking concept applying reasoning system. And in Bellman's case, the rational desire amounts to merely animal desire integrated with practical reason, conceived as, quote, a mechanism modifying the motivational forces already at work. The underlying conception here is of the human mind still as an entity that consists of two distinct and self-standing strata, or as I put it before in my cake analogy, layers, which must be bridged in some way for these processes of action and perception to transpire. Indeed, many philosophers take, I think, often somewhat inchoately, something like what I'm calling the layer cake conception to be obligatory. If we're going to do justice in our philosophizing to the fact that we are, after all, animals, aren't we? And if we are animals, even if we say we're rational animals, doesn't that mean that we must share something in common? We must share a nature in common with non-rational animals? So the question becomes here, what sense of in common is required to make sense of the fact that we are animals too? On the alternative conception, the one that I'm saying the mature Nietzsche proposes, our culturally acquired capacities make a fundamental difference, the nature of our perceiving. They confer a particular form on our perceptual sensitivity to the environment, one whose operations are themselves informed by our capacities to speak, think, value, reflect, weigh reasons, make decisions, make promises. And something similar for later Nietzsche is also true of the relation between desire and thought. And if that's right, then our power to acquire such knowledge and to gauge in such action, he thinks, cannot be accounted for in what I call the layer cake style. For if what perception and motivation properly understood in the human case signify cannot be explained without reference to things like our ability to speak and make promises, then what perceiving and desire come to in the human animal cannot be explained in what we might call a factorizing way, starting with a bare power of perceiving and desiring, and then supplementing it with further powers to monitor or regulate the first in the light of some culturally added module for judging or reasoning or weighing. So what we get in Nietzsche is a conception of human mindedness that I've called on my handout, a transformative conception of human mindedness. And as it says in item 13 of your handout, such a conception takes the very nature of perceiving and desiring to themselves be transformed through and through by the advent of what I've been calling, somewhat misleadingly, using the other conception describes them as our merely culturally acquired capacity. But the very way of individuating that actually reflects the other picture. That is, they are transformed in a manner that renders what perception and desire are in the human animal something irreducibly different from their counterparts in non-human animals. The dualist reading of Nietzsche's understanding of the relation between culture and nature, I'm saying, presupposes, if we look carefully, the layer cake conception. What I'm calling the dialectical reading presupposes the transformative conception. Most interpretations of Nietzsche depend critically on which of these two conceptions they favor, at least implicitly, and to what degree. And in my experience, most readings are at best unclear about this issue. And where they're clear, they're wrong. So, it's worth remarking that a particular obstacle often stands in the way of seeing that the mature Nietzsche favors something like what I'm calling the transformative conception. And this obstacle comes from often having Nietzsche's target be someone who is basically a Cartesian, but not thinking carefully about what Nietzsche's critique of Platonic Cartesian philosophy is. So we know that Nietzsche wants to reject some kind of Cartesian dualism of mind and body. The Cartesian thinks there's something distinctive about mind that makes it impossible to accommodate its properties as modes of an essentially embodied being. And commentators rightly take Nietzsche to want to deny that Cartesian conclusion. The question is, how do we deny it? They have been denying this in a way that reason is also denying something further. The very thing that I think Nietzsche most wants to affirm. They wind up having him say something that blocks Nietzsche's conception of what's so special about the human animal. To be clear about how to reject Cartesianism without giving up the point that's central to mature Nietzsche, we need to be clear about where the real difference lies between the layer cake conception and the transformative conception. And I think thinking about Cartesianism is a helpful vehicle for getting clear about this. The crucial difference between these two conceptions is not this. The layer cake conception, it's not just saying there's something layer cake conception myths, which the transformative one denies, namely that the minds of human and non-human creatures have something in common. They both think they have something in common. The question is how they understand the idea of something in common. That's where the real dispute lies. The layer cake conception advocates, indeed, as I'd say, it's in the grip of a picture of a certain way of understanding what we must have in common with the non-human animal in order to avoid Cartesianism. It involves what John McDowell calls a highest common factor assumption. That is, that there's a common factor that persists untransformed and operates in essentially the same way as we go from the case of the merely animal to the human. Thus, according to the layer cake conception, there must be a distinguishable factor in the fully human powers of perception action, which is the very same in kind as the factor that wholly constitutes merely animal powers of perception action. The transformative conception, by contrast, holds that human mentality and non-human animal mentality are different species of a single genus called animal mentality, if you like. But what the two have in common on this view is not a separable factor present in both, something like a common denominator, which is wholly untransformed as we look from one case to the other, but a generic structure that has come to be realized in fundamentally different ways in the two cases. Human animals do not share in the sensory incarnate powers of non-human animals. They share in the sensory incarnate powers of animals, where this is a generic category of capacity that has come to admit of a fundamentally different sort of realization in each of us over the course of the human cultural transformation of the sort of animal we are. So I'll just conclude with a remark about Cartesianism. And then we can point to the end of the paper, which you won't get from the talk, and then we can start a discussion. So it's helpful, I think, this is the point of item 14, where I've broken up what Cartesianism holds in a certain way, to see how the layer cake conception and the transformative conception are actually responding to Cartesianism in very different ways. What the layer cake conception does is keep a form of dualism while trying to avoid Cartesian dualism. What the transformative conception does is see the dualistic form of the conception as the real problem, and to see the transition to the layer cake conception as merely treating the symptom and not the cause of the philosophical problem. So it helps to see Cartesianism is claiming two separate things, which I've given you as one and two under item 14 in the handout. One is the idea that there's something special and different about the mental life of a human being that makes it impossible to see it, at least in its presently most distinctive aspects, as sharing a highest common factor with that of an animal, a kind of animal that's incapable of thought or evaluation. That's one idea. We could say the Cartesian idea is, there's something special. Look how amazingly different we humans are from animals. Animals can't do this, animals can't do that. And two, that this difference should be philosophically accounted for by tacking a supplementary layer onto a lower, untransformed layer of our animal nature. Descartes does it by tacking a body onto a mind. Now, from Nietzsche's point of view, the first of these two things we might call the truth in Cartesianism. And the second is what we might call its crucial underlying error. What happens in Nietzsche's early thought, what happens in Nietzsche's commentary, what happens in most contemporary analytic philosophy of mind and action, is that one is rejected, and we try to implement two in a different way than the way Descartes did. So we try to implement what, from Nietzsche's point of view, is some more highly refined version of the crucial error in Cartesianism. So in quotations 10 to 11, from Evans and Bellamy on the handout, the mistake in Cartesianism is not taken to be the layer cake conception itself, but rather merely something that has to do with the Cartesian way of implementing it, through an immaterial mind. In a material body. We have to materialize the two factors, and then we've solved the problem. So what they seek instead is a demystified and scientifically updated version of the character of the tacked on layer. But I think for Nietzsche, that merely represses the real cause of our trouble in this area of philosophy, or so I've tried to suggest the mature Nietzsche holds. Then what I go on and do in the paper, which I won't do in the talk, but I'll just mention, I give you some handouts at the end, some quotations, at the end of the handout from part three of the genealogy, is then I try to show how we can see Nietzsche in the third part of the genealogy, having identified this assumption, as then trying to see what it would be to think about who we are and live in such a way that we are actually freeing ourselves from this assumption. And that, I think, is the framework one needs for reading that part of the genealogy. Thank you very much.